Remember when BP said it capped the oil well in the Gulf of Mexico?
Can they take that back?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, July 19th. Reports this morning suggest that the capped BP well is seeping oil.
J.P. Morgan may be saying so long to London. U.S. governments crunch the numbers on fixing roads and decide they have some crunching to do. But first,
BP says its cap on the leaking oil well in the Gulf should stay in place until the leak can be shut off for good. The government, on the other hand, says the oil seepage means the cap may need to be lifted soon. Here to explain is Marketplace's John Dimsdale from our Washington Bureau. Hi, John.
Good morning, Steve.
So is the oil still leaking into the Gulf?
Well, the cap is holding, but the oil is trying to find other ways out and appears to be popping out in some other places on the seabed. And that makes it more difficult to detect and contain the leaking oil. Still, the government's going to allow BP to keep the cap in place for another 24 hours while monitoring as much as possible for other leaks.
And what's the risk, John, of leaving the cap on?
Well, I put that question to Clifford Jones, oil engineering expert at the University of Aberdeen in the UK.
What's feared, perhaps most, is that if this cap were to fail, it could leave a hole bigger than the original one, in which case there'd be more abundant leakage of oil than there now is.
All right, so it's clear that this whole leak has cost the regional ecosystem and the economy down there, John. I mean, what is this costing BP?
Well, the company's now saying that it's $4 billion and counting and is in the process of selling some of its assets to pay for the spill and the cleanup. Now, the company did get some good news from the federal administrator of that spill compensation fund, Kenneth Feinberg, over the weekend. He says that the wages earned by people working on BP's cleanup will be deducted from their claims against the company, which means some of the money BP is spending now will reduce its future liabilities.
All right. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reporting live from our Washington Bureau. John, thanks.
Thanks.
And yet another sign the economic recovery is slowing down. We got word from the National Association of Home Builders that its housing market index fell in July to its lowest level since March 2009.
For more on the housing picture, we turn to economist Julia Coronado at BNP Paribas. She joins us every Monday from New York. Hi, Julia.
Good morning.
Julia, one of the problems facing the housing market is excess supply. When you got more houses than anybody wants, why build more? So what can be done about that problem short of bulldozing?
Well, that's exactly right. It's the flow of foreclosed properties coming onto the market means there's just this tremendous excess supply. And one way to go through this is just to let population growth absorb it very slowly over time. But actually, bulldozing is an option in particular communities that are have a particularly large overhang of homes. It's something that was quite helpful in the Cash for Clunkers program, for example, where existing cars were just destroyed, and that forced people to buy new cars, and that helped spur demand in the auto industry. So destruction of supply is a bridge we might cross at some point.
Wow, has it come to this? Julia Coronado, U.S. economist, senior U.S. economist at BNP Paribas in New York. Thank you, Julia.
My pleasure.
You're listening to the Midday Update from Monday, July 19th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. We're going to get a take on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects the United States. Remember when experts warned that taxing big banks in one country would just drive them across the border to another country? Well, there are reports this morning that J.P. Morgan Chase is threatening to drastically reduce its business in the U.K. Here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London.
J.P. Morgan is reportedly on the brink of scrapping plans for a new $2 billion headquarters in London. Press reports say the bank is alarmed by the level of banker bashing in Britain and that it's concerned about a string of new taxes, especially those targeting banks and bankers' pay. No one at JP Morgan was available to comment, but Stuart Fraser, an official representative for London's financial centre, says he's taking the threat seriously.
I think you can certainly take it. There's a shot across the bows. We need to be aware when we impose any form of tax or change a tax that London sits in a global competitive position.
He points out that planned bank taxes in the US and continental Europe have either been scrapped or postponed. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
And about 30 miles southwest of London, it's the aviation industry's biggest gathering, the Farnborough Air Show. That's where Emirates Airlines today announced it's going to buy 30 new aircraft from Boeing. That's a deal that could be worth $9 billion. Now, Boeing's already making news over there after landing its new Dreamliner for the first time outside the United States. The BBC's Theo Leggett is with us from Farnborough with the latest. Hi, Theo.
Hi there.
So Boeing landed this new 787 Dreamliner at the show. Anything significant about its plan for the industry?
Yeah, well, Boeing landed this aircraft a day early, a day ahead of the start of the show, trying to steal the headlines, I think. And this is a very significant aircraft for Boeing. It's built almost entirely of what's basically plastic. It's carbon composites. And what that means is that the aircraft is much lighter than other aircraft, which means it uses less fuel. Now, I spoke to James Albaugh, who's chief executive of Boeing Commercial Airplanes, and he told me this airplane will change the industry.
Well, I tell you, I think this is going to be the most efficient airplane ever built. This is going to be an airplane that can fly further. This is an airplane that's going to provide, you know, much more comfort for the passengers. This is an airplane that I think will change the world.
Theo, what is Farnborough? Why is Farnborough so important?
Well, Farnborough is a very unusual event. This is a tremendous arms and aircraft fair where thousands of exhibitors come along to show their latest product and try to gain customers.
How's the industry feeling after the downturn of the past couple of years? I mean, these are pretty expensive planes. Do sales there indicate anything about a recovery?
Well, it's a tale of two industries, really. On the commercial side, the passenger planes, people are looking a lot more confident than they did a year ago at the Paris Air Show. This year, we're being told to expect quite a few orders. But on the other side, on the defense side, people are being a lot more cautious. They know that governments have less money than they used to have. They know that the good years of ever-increasing defense spending are probably over, and they're going to have to tighten their belts. It's going to be harder to sell military hardware.
The BBC's Theo Leggett joining us from Farnborough. Theo, thank you.
Thank you very much.
One man has bought up a large part of the world's supply of cocoa. Usually hedge funds buy and sell small bits of commodities such as coffee or cocoa, but British investor Anthony Ward has just taken delivery of $1 billion worth of cocoa beans. It's the largest single purchase in 14 years and has pushed the price of cocoa up to a 33-year high. The BBC's Rebecca Singer reports for Marketplace.
Imagine five ships the size of the Titanic filled with cocoa beans. That's what 240,000 tons looks like, and it's equivalent to Europe's entire supply of chocolate's most vital ingredient. Chris Skinner is a markets commentator and says Anthony Ward has done this before. 8 years ago, he bought 200,000 tons and made $60 million.
I guess it's a bit like the film Trading Places with Eddie Murphy, that, you know, the pork bellies. If you control that supply, you hold on to it and you squeeze the market, you see the price going up, and at some point release those supplies and then you make a mint.
Cocoa prices have more than doubled over the past 2.5 years. Production in Africa has fallen and demand from India and China has gone up. And Ward is betting on them rising further, especially in the run-up to Christmas. But critics aren't impressed.
We see this speculation all the time in food markets, in coffee, in wheat, and this has real impacts on people across the world.
Tim Jones is from the World Development Movement. He says ordinary people in developing countries are pushed into poverty as food prices rise. The new financial reform bill in the US is designed to control the influence speculators can have on the market, and Jones wants the European Union to make similar reforms.
So the market can still function, but the limit prevents the hot money coming in and out and so helps to stabilise the prices.
Chocolate lovers might not thank Ward for helping push up the price of their chocolate bars, but warehouse owners will certainly be licking their lips. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
We thought we'd test our sweet knowledge of international affairs once again, as we do every so often, and we're glad to bring in Stefan Richter with this morning's Marketplace Globalist Quiz. Good morning, Stefan.
Good morning, Steve. Are you ready for today's quiz?
I am so ready. Let's do it.
Which group of African countries grew the most in terms of its economy last year? Is it A, the oil exporters, countries such as Nigeria, B, the fragile states, think Congo, for example, C, middle-income countries, like the World Cup host South Africa, or D, low-income countries, Zambia, Uganda, and countries like that?
I'm going to have to say the oil exporters.
That would be the likely answer. But, you know, they only grew by 3.8%. While that's impressive in a global context, because the rest of the world certainly didn't grow anywhere near as fast, it wasn't the fastest in Africa last year.
So, all right, I'm obviously not even getting the parting gift on this game show, Stefan. So I'm going to guess the least among them, including the impoverished nations that you mentioned.
And you've got it. It is really fascinating that Mozambique, Zambia, and so on grew by almost 5% last year, and it wasn't a fluke. That is due to things like, you know, a little bit of governance, reduction of wasteful spending, improvements in education and health systems, and trade policy reform. So it shows that sub-Saharan Africa's economies can actually be more resilient in terms of economic growth than the developed countries.
Well, we'll see if that trickles down to the people there of some of those impoverished nations of Africa.
That's the key question.
That it truly is. Stefan Richter is publisher and editor-in-chief of The Globalist. To learn more about the global economy, politics, and culture, visit theglobalist.com. Listening to the Midday Update for Monday, July 19th. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We've got a study today that found venture capitalists funneled a lot more money into American startup companies. Dow Jones Venture Source says investments between April and June shot up 53% over last year. That's the most money invested in startups since the third quarter of 2008. What does it all mean? Jessica Canning is Global Research Director for Dow Jones Venture Source. She's with us live from San Francisco this morning. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
Doing well. So what's driving this increase? What kind of investments are growing?
For the most part, it's because of the increased economic stability paired with a stronger liquidity environment, which had really sidelined venture investors over the past year.
Liquidity. When I hear liquidity, I start to fall asleep. So what does that mean? Does that mean there's a lot of capital in the market, a lot of money out there?
That's essentially IPOs and acquisitions are finally starting to take place again. The IPO window is starting to open up with companies like Tesla coming through. So that's what venture investors, that's how they get their returns.
We know that it's bound to be good for the U.S. economy long term, all this investment. But what about jobs? Can these investments turn into jobs?
They actually turn immediately and directly into jobs. These are brand new companies that didn't exist before, and so also jobs that didn't exist before. So they're not even rehire jobs. They're really brand new jobs in the economy.
What can we expect, do you think, from venture capital over the next year or so?
Although it is difficult to say right now because there continues to be some economic uncertainty, the fact that venture investors raised over $7.5 billion in funds in the first half of this year, which is an increase over last year, they are going to put that capital into play right away.
They're going to put that capital. So what's the process? Take us through real quick the process.
So essentially, venture investors have to raise money from their limited partners, which tend to be pension funds. And they raise a fund, which usually has a lifespan of about 10 years, and start investing over the life cycle of that fund for 10 years into privately held companies.
And that's how they do it, and they make that transfer.
And then they make the return when the company goes public or gets acquired.
Interesting. All right. Well, Jessica Canning from Dow Jones Venture Source, the source of this study, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
The lobbying battle over the financial reform bill won't end when President Obama signs it into law this week. Far from it. The bill left some crucial details and tough decisions up to federal regulators who will be implementing those new laws. And in Washington fashion, lobbyists are gearing up to influence how those regulators will write the new rules. Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
Lobbying federal regulators is different from lobbying Congress. In Congress, you're trying to influence hundreds of lawmakers. But with regulators, you can be lobbying an audience of one, with even greater influence. John Wunderlich is policy director at the Sunlight Foundation, a lobbying watchdog. He says sometimes the regulators are at a disadvantage.
They'll be starting their careers, and the lobbyist that comes in to meet with them is 2 decades further into their career and has far more experience and expertise.
In some cases, the lobbyist used to sit in the regulator's seat. John Taylor is a consumer advocate and head of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition.
The very same folks who are regulating you one day pop up as working for the banks and even being their lobbyists.
And Taylor says because the lobbyists know the lay of the land, they often get what they want. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Last winter, the blogosphere got a hold of some leaked emails between climate scientists, and accusations of fudged data started flying. A slew of investigations since then have cleared the scientists of any wrongdoing. But still, it got those who study climate change thinking. Maybe they need a little work on their brand. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark has that story.
Maybe you've seen the ads. A round-cheeked little boy in a baseball uniform peers through a magnifying glass at a cluster of daisies. It's supposed to be a younger version of biologist David Inouye.
People will look twice at that little boy in a Little League uniform, whereas they might not look twice at a picture of the real me, a 60-year-old scientist.
Inouye says the idea is to put a human face, an adorable one, on climate scientists like him. The ads point you to a website where you can read more about their work. Kevin Knobloch runs the Union of Concerned Scientists, the group behind the campaign. He says many of his members have been under attack lately.
Some climate scientists have received death threats, a drumbeat of really disturbing kinds of emails from people who are often anonymous.
Knobloch wants that to change once people understand who these scientists are and what motivates them. While science needs to stick to the cold facts, he hopes to shift public opinion with a warm feeling. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
The new healthcare law will not start controlling costs for at least a few years. Meantime, there's an organization in Tijuana, Mexico, that would like to save you some money on care, as Kevin Ferguson reports.
For decades, Americans have headed south to Mexico for cheap prescription drugs and dental work, but a liver transplant or back surgery? Most patients say no thanks. Patrick Osio wants to change their minds.
Outside of the United States, there are more American students in medical schools in Mexico than anywhere else in the world. And they certainly go back and practice medicine in the United States. And so the training that the Mexican doctor receives is top-notch.
Osio is vice president of the Baja California Medical Tourism Association, which formed in 2008. The organization is sort of a mix between a PR firm and an accreditation service. It reviews and certifies healthcare providers in Baja California and refers American patients to the region's hospitals and doctors, places like Excel Medical Center in Tijuana. From the inside, Excel looks like your average American hospital, high-tech equipment, spotless floors. Jose Hernandez is CEO of Excel and a cardiovascular surgeon. He says given our two nations' political and trade partnerships, Mexico is America's best option for medical tourism.
We could be more accountable if it's a bad result of whatever happens to the citizen in the United States.
Hernandez says many of Excel's patients are uninsured Americans, people like Dwayne Walker of San Antonio, Texas. When he needed a triple bypass, he contacted a medical tourism group called World Medicist. Not long after, he was on a plane to Tijuana.
We knew the doctors involved were U.S. trained and were quite competent. We really didn't have any reservations in that regard.
Walker saved almost $100,000 on his heart surgery. But Judy Dugan of Consumer Watchdog says there's no way to know how safe these procedures are.
I mean, that medical facilities can look gorgeous. The doctor's credentials can look good. But, you know, really, you can't tell.
Dugan agrees that the choice is up to consumers. But as domestic healthcare costs continue to climb and companies try to save money, that might soon change. In Tijuana, I'm Kevin Ferguson for Marketplace.
And finally, the Wall Street Journal reports many rural governments are giving up in the fight against potholes. Apparently, the price of asphalt cement has doubled in the last decade. Plus, there's that state and local budget crunch you've been hearing about so much. So now officials are opting to grind the pavement back to gravel.
Back to gravel. You know, someday the dust and the bumpy ride and the cracked windshields will lead to calls to repave those roads. Mm-hmm. That's how you'll know the economy has recovered. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.